Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Japan. When you think of that country, your first thoughts may turn to Godzilla, as do mine, but not necessarily God. In many respects, Japan has a reputation for not being one of the most religious countries in the world. Its nearby neighbors of South Korea and China have garnered much more attention in terms of their changing religious landscapes than Japan ever has, at least here in the United States. Well, just because we do not talk about the religiosity of Japan very much does not mean that we should not talk about that topic. And so today we dive into the world of religion in Japan with a previous guest we've had on the show, Dr. Kevin Cooney. Kevin is a professor of business and political science at Northwest University in Kirkland, Washington, where he also serves as the director of the Pacific Rim Center in the School of Business and Management. Kevin is an extensive world traveler, having spent large portions of his life not only in the Asian nations of Japan and China, but he has also planted his feet in over 50 countries around the world, covering nearly every continent except Antarctica, if I am correct. Kevin is also the author of Japan's Foreign Policy Maturation, A Quest for Normalcy. And he spoke to us about a year ago about a trip to China to investigate religious freedom in that country. We'll go ahead and link to that podcast so you can check that one out. But today, we talk of Japan. And just to fill folks in on where we're conducting this interview, in case you hear ambient noise in the background, I am once again in the familiar confines of Match Coffee and Wine Bar in the burgeoning metropolis of Duval, Washington. This spot is rapidly becoming one of my favorite interview spots, so don't be alarmed if you hear an order up for cappuccino there in the background. Hey, Kevin, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to be back.
Now, I just want to tell the listeners here that even though we are at Match Coffee and Wine Bar, we do not have any wine in front of us at this moment.
That is absolutely correct.
All right. Well, let's get into this issue of Japan here. I know little, if anything, about the religious climate in that nation. So this is going to be a fun conversation for me. I'm going to learn a lot of stuff here. And I actually have to admit, too, that the words religion and Japan, they're rarely mentioned in the same sentence. So tell me and our listeners, what would we see religiously if we got off the plane in Tokyo today?
Well, if you got off the plane in Tokyo today, one of the things is you'd be struck by contrast. This is a nation that is, in many ways, is extremely religious and not religious at the same time.
Oh.
It is said that in Japan that Japanese, they're born Shinto, they marry Christian, and they die Buddhist because they like the ceremonies for each of those occasions.
Uh-huh. I have heard that. So explain that a little bit.
Okay. The Japanese mentality seems to be that they don't want to deny or reject any particular religion, but they don't want to actually fully commit to any particular religion at the same time. Now, I'm speaking in generalizations here. There are many Japanese who I know are sincere Shintoists, Buddhists, Christians, but in the generality is that they will respect all religions, but not dive deeply into any particular one.
Is there kind of a cafeteria approach to religion where, you know, as you say, you're born Shinto, you marry Christian, so, oh yeah, I like that whole church wedding thing going on, and you die Buddhist because of the death ceremonies there. Is there this kind of picking and choosing and blending syncretically that you see a lot there?
Yes, that's exactly what it is. And it literally has to do with what gives them the pleasure for the particular ceremony and what have you. In fact, one of the major industries within Japan is wedding services. If you looked at the James Bond film, You Only Live Twice, he actually has a wedding ceremony, and it's a very Shinto ceremony. I had lived in Japan for many years. I never went to or ever went to a Shinto wedding ceremony, though I went to dozens of Christian wedding ceremonies between two Japanese who are not Christian in any way, but they like the ceremony. They'll get even a Caucasian minister to be there to officiate and do the wedding.
They hold whole stained glass windows and stuff like that?
Everything.
Okay.
A whole facade on the inside is quite amazing to see this industry there.
Okay. And what about outside of religions or major life ceremonies such as birth and death? Is there a lot of religious practice that goes on? Does it have that syncretist flavor to it? Is people just worshiping privately in their home, or is it some kind of organized services that you see?
Well, it would vary depending on which religion you're kind of talking about. Japan is 60 to 70% Shinto, which is is Japan's native religion. It borrows a lot of things from Buddhism, but it's basically an animist religion. It is very nature orientated. It has various ceremonies that revolve around the seasons, the blessing of the rice harvest by the emperor, and the planting also by the emperor, and different functions that go on actually through the year that reflect kind of a nature agrarian society along those lines. Then you have your Buddhism with all its different variants that occur, which is anywhere from usually 20 to 25%. Some people will put it as high as 30%. On that, for the adherence to it. And they actually do tend to be, in my observation, because they do go to their temples more often, whereas the Japanese Shinto, they only go on special occasions and holidays to the shrine. There's not necessarily a particular religious service that you go to on a weekly basis on that.
Then, so it's kind of a picking and choosing when you go to the temple.
The temple for Buddhism, no, they will actually go there for teachings and other things like that. But the shrines. Yeah, the shrines are what they differentiate. The Shinto shrine, Buddhist temple, and then there's the Christian church. And the last one is Christianity makes up about 1%. It's been a fairly solid 1% over time, evenly split between Catholics and Protestants there. And that's an interesting history. But that is there. So Christians are probably the only ones that actually go pretty much on a very regular weekly basis, except for the expat community, of which then you've then got Muslims and Hindus, but they number in anywhere from a few 10,000 to 100,000 or something mm-hmm. like that.
Okay. Well, I do want to talk a little bit about Buddhism and Shintoism and kind of give us a flavor for what those religions are. You lived there for several years. How long have you lived in Japan on and off? I know you've been there.
I've lived there over 5 years.
Okay. And so give us a flavor for what Shintoism and Buddhism is. I don't want to make that the focus of this podcast because I do actually want to talk about Christianity there, but kind of give us that context of what the beliefs and practices tend to be.
Okay, when you get to Shinto, I mean, you cannot see Japan unless you are exposed to Shinto religion / culture. Japanese culture just is a blend of Shintoism. Any ceremony, particularly like New Year's in particular, there's a big thing where you actually will see crowds of people heading down the street to the shrine to make the first visit just shortly after midnight. And it will continue for a few days afterwards for those who are wanting to go make that first visit. You'll see that as you go through many of the historical sites are usually old shrines that have existed for a long time. That is the part of Japan that you see the drums on the streets, the festivals and things like that all usually revolve around the shrine of the city or the town that is there, and everyone has one. And then there's like usually like one major one, like where I lived in Hokkaido, the northern island, they have Hokkaido Jingu, which is the Hokkaido shrine, and it's the major one for the whole island. And that was a more recent build because Hokkaido was an island that was settled by the Japanese about 150 years ago, and they kind of pushed out the aboriginal people there, the Ainu, which are they're the southernmost of the northern peoples.
Okay.
on that. So.
And did those indigenous folks there that were on Hokkaido, did they have a separate religion from Shintoism, or are they kind of?
Yeah.
So they did. Okay.
That would be more reflective of what are, say, Native American, the Inuit, the Laps, the Aleutian, different things. They would follow along the lines of those religions that there. And there are only about 200 to 400 pureblood Ainu left that still can claim pure blood now.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that Shintoism, you mentioned that's the older temple or places that you see in Japan. Roughly how far back does that go in Japan? I don't know anything about Japanese history here.
Well, for Shintoism, basically, if you really want to go back to the founding, goes back to the founding of Japan. Okay. And that, I mean, the legend is that the first emperor was the offspring of the sun goddess who came down to earth, and thus the emperor was a divine creature, that kind of divine human that lit all the way down. And this belief was prevalent and locked into Japanese society all the way down till Hirohito, when in his famous announcement on the radio with Japan's surrender, is that he declared that he was not a god, he was merely a mortal. And that basically kind of ended that kind of idea, at least in the public way, though you still do have some strong right-wing political nationalistic groups in Japan that actually will subscribe to that. And if you look at old Japanese films and you see reactions of people when they see the picture of the emperor, you kind of get the idea that they're kind of looking at more than, like, say, a Catholic would look at a pope, but you're looking at the idea of the image of a god.
Is this a kind of idea of divine right kingship that you saw in Europe for a while and probably around the world too at various points in time?
Even more so, because they actually believe it was a divine being. It was that the sun goddess had actually birthed the first emperor.
Okay. And so, how long ago was that Japan was founded? I mean, what kind of history are we talking about?
If you're talking about the legend, you're talking it goes back several thousand years before Christ. Okay. If you're talking archaeological evidence, you're talking you can only go back to probably between 400 and 700 AD that they actually have evidence of the continuous emperor in Japan. There's some patchwork that they can actually prove a continuous line of the same emperor. Now, obviously, for the nationalists believe that there has been, and they actually do have a lineage that they actually have down on paper, but being able to prove that independent of the actual tradition that the nationalists have established in a long Shinto tradition, they have not been. And it's been a bit of a controversy among scholars within Japan, is this history.
So you had some experience out there in Japan. You got to know a number of people. And one of the major theories in the study of religion over the past several decades has been this idea of secularization theory. As people modernize, or as societies modernize, they become less religious. Have you perhaps witnessed that people are dropping Shinto beliefs or anything along that line? Do you sense some secularization occurring within Japan?
Yes, very much so. Almost to the point where just people pick the religion that they want, and the religion is kind of whatever they feel like or do want. And if you look at some scholars, and it depends on how the question is worded, and sometimes it's like how the person's mood at the time when they answer it, but Japan comes out oftentimes as one of the most secular or unreligious nations in the world. I hesitate to say the word atheist, but I would say agnostic would be a stronger thing of not knowing or necessarily caring, but again, caring is too strong. Say not caring is too strong, because I think it's like, yeah, if God showed himself to them, they'd say, oh yeah, okay, and that would be something.
Do you think there's a general reluctance of people to talk about religion in Japanese society? In the United States, we oftentimes talk about it very openly, even though we're told, you know, polite people don't talk about religion or politics in social gatherings. We still do. We talk about our religious faith quite a bit. We wear it on our sleeves, so to speak. Is there much more reluctance to talk about that in Japan?
I Believe so, especially when you get to religions outside of Shintoism. Buddhism, because of its numbers, is a little bit stronger, but during the nationalistic period that was basically from the end of the Meiji era through the Second World War, non-Shinto religions were actively persecuted in Japan. This includes Christianity, this includes Buddhism, and you were considered un-Japanese. And this is probably one of the greatest crimes that, quote, a Japanese can be accused of, is saying that you are un-Japanese or you're not typical Japanese, because that means you've kind of taken away the you've abandoned what makes you uniquely Japanese. And this gets into a lot into the Shinto. It gets into what you're believing in the religion, and it gets in to just that cultural basis that is based on the nation of Japan.
Now that brings me to this interesting question. I want to turn our discussion to Christianity, and I want to get a little bit of the history of Christianity in Japan from you, but you're an outsider. When you live there, you're not Japanese, and so that, you know, you're an outsider in a different country, and you're also Christian. Right, in this nation that, you know, you're saying, you know, roughly 1% of the population is Christian. When you lived there for 5 years on and off at various points in time in your life, how did you deal with that? Did you have a church down the street that you regularly went to, or was this something you kind of had to keep being Christian on your own by just praying every day and in the house kind of thing? How did you manage that as an outsider in this country?
Well, actually, the funny thing when you say that, just down the street, I actually, just down the street from my apartment in Japan, there was a small Catholic church that's had probably 30, 35 members in a city that had 120,000 people in it. But it just happened to be down the street. I became good friends with the pastor, who was Japanese, the priest there himself, but he trained in France to become a priest. The family's there, and I would go there, and I would attend there, be there for their particular festivals and things like that around Christmas and New Year's, and I would say it's one of the interesting things that's typical, I think, of Japanese Christians, and somewhat, in some lesser extent, Buddhists in Japan, is that they try to show their Japanese-ness more than actually Japanese themselves do, in the sense of Japanese Shinto, or those who are more nominally Shinto. And when I threw out those percentages earlier, I'm talking about a nominal affiliation.
Right.
And as the smaller the religion gets in population, then I would say the less nominal it gets. Like, I know very few nominal Japanese Christians.
Christian, you're going to be Christian. Diving into it.
Yes, you have a certain commitment to it that you identify with, because you've made that. There's a social cost to being outside the majority on it. But they do tend to actually follow the major ceremonies and what have you a lot more. So I attended there. And then I also take a half-hour train ride into the major city of Sapporo, which has was Japan's fifth largest city. And I would attend a non-denominational international church that had bilingual services in both Japanese and English. The pastor was an American seminary graduate who came over as a missionary. His wife was Japanese. It's a thriving church. In fact, it's actually considered a very large church by Japanese standards, where just to give you a perspective, the average church in Japan has about 20 members. That's the average size. And this church was, I'd say right now, when I was there last summer and visited, it has about 250 to 280 steady members.
Yeah, which is still, I mean, it's still pretty small. I think the average church size in the United States gets into about 70 to 100 or so. But how does, and I'm interested in that Catholic church down the street from you where you lived. I mean, 20, 25 members. How does a church like that survive?
I think they survive really well on community. Mm-hmm. This was a very tight community. Everybody knew each other. Everybody was invested in the lives of the children within the church and what have you. I mean, they loved having me there. I was this being this foreigner who had was coming in, and mind you, this was 20 plus years ago. and I was there. But I really, it was just kind of that, I really felt I was part of a family and community that when I was part of that group there. And I think that's how they actually survive, and they work together, and everybody's constantly contributing. There's a very strong sense of volunteerism within the church. Everybody just pitches in and does everything. There's no, I mean, the cost that they ask for is like, oh, you pay for, we're having lunch after church. Okay, you're chipping in 500 yen to pay for lunch. Okay, that's a typical, that's like $5 or something like that to do it. It's not like Shinto and Buddhism, where there's a whole industry behind a lot of their ceremonies, where, I mean, if you hear of someone being a Shinto priest or a Buddhist priest, you're saying, oh, that guy's rich. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of money behind that.
Mm-hmm. So, it's, you know, like you see in many other societies, it's a minority community that usually strengthens the bond. One of the interesting things that you said, though, too, is that despite the fact that they are a minority religion and have taken that step to be not the historical religion, not Shintoism, they still nonetheless want to prove their Japanese-ness, more so than other Japanese, right? They want to say, yeah, we're different than you, but we're really part of you as well. I can see that as a strong theme in how they'd want to present themselves to society.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, tell us a little bit about Christianity historically in Japan. Now, I know when we were talking about getting together to do this interview, you were giving me some information that was rather surprising to me. I would say if somebody just came to me right now off the street and said, hey, when did Christianity come to Japan? I'd say, well, you know, I guess, I don't know, maybe after World War II or, you know, I don't know, maybe it was a little bit earlier back in the 1800s when Admiral Perry came with his four black ships and the United States, you know, kind of pushed its way into Japan. But what is the history of Christianity in Japan?
Well, most people would point to 1549 with Francis Xavier and the Jesuits arriving in Japan. However, one of the things that is actually noted that a lot of people don't realize, and I've over the years in my research and just studying Japan, I've come across the things that what is often misnamed the Nestorian Church, but it's the Church of the East. This is the remnants of which are the indigenous churches to Iraq and Syria, of people who followed the conflict over in Iraq there and the current one going on in Syria. You can see that you have this indigenous church that kind of still exists. At one point, this church, it was outside of the Roman Empire, so it's kind of got separated. Some of the apostles went over into this area. We do know that historically, but it was cut off from, say, Peter and Paul, who stayed in the western part of the Roman Empire. Eventually, it grew to the point where they had a lot of missionaries. It was a very evangelical church, small evangelical. They sent missionaries out. Their church records show at one point they had over 200 bishops in China.
Wow.
These are the records that they show, and this was in around 400 AD.
Yeah, and that is surprising. I think one of our other guests, I think it was Jim Papandrea, had mentioned this fact as well about how we normally, as Christians, we normally think about the church being in the Middle East area and then spreading into Rome and to Northern Africa. We often forget how far east it went in a relatively short period of time, considering transportation and that during that era of the world, but all the way to China 400 years after its birth. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and what is actually amazing, and I'm going to use the term Nestorian because that's how it's referred to in a lot of the literature, though I do know they do not like that term because the doctrine of Nestorius was a heretical doctrine according to Christianity, and they don't like being associated with it. But it's the name that is often used in the literature in the West to describe the church. But the stories have it, and there's some archaeological evidence that actually backs this up, that you have that some of these missionaries that went to China actually made their way to Japan in the 4th and 5th century A.D.
Mm-hmm.
That they actually, that early.
Quite early, yeah.
And according to the legend, and this is where I'm going to kind of separate from legend versus the factual thing. Legend was that a couple missionaries came, they were brought before the emperor's court, and the empress had a child that was very ill, and they prayed over this child, and this child was healed, and she converted to Christianity along with her courtesans and household and what have you, was the idea with the empress there. And that was, quote, the birth of Christianity in Japan. Now, getting to the archaeological thing, a lot of these older shrines that I'm talking about, they have discovered in them these Nestorian crosses imprinted at certain points within the architecture that date back to this time period. Now, this is an indication of something. We don't know the whole story behind it, but that's kind of that interesting thing. Whatever it was, this Church of the East, the Nestorian Church, however you want to do it, fell into decline and eventually disappeared, except for in its home area in the Middle East and in small areas within India and a few other locations, and it kind of disappeared at some point in time in history. But the real opening to Japan for Christianity was when Francis Xavier came in. And this is, when you're thinking 1549, this is just when in Europe they're starting the Protestant split going on there,
right,
with the Luther nails his 95 theses to the church door in Wittenberg. But the thing is, these missionaries, they come with the Portuguese, they're trading, but they're selling. They have some great conversions in southern Japan, and there's a period of history here where Christians are birthed, and they talk about it getting up to like 20-30% of the population at that time. But then the thing is, I mentioned this in southern Japan. Japan was also divided politically at this time between various warlords. And one important thing that for your listeners to understand, the emperor has traditionally in Japan not been a powerful figure. It's been who controls the emperor controls Japan, not the other way around. And you don't have really a history of strong emperors. You have strong warlords who in turn manipulate the emperor or the office to do things in the name of the emperor to their will.
So even that, even though the emperor's a divine being, still almost plays second fiddle to whoever happens to be at the top of the warlord heap at the moment.
Yes. And Christianity swan smack into a battle between two various factions, and they actually ended up on the side of the losing warlord, and the establishment of basically the shogunate that decided to expel foreigners from Japan, including all missionaries, and this happened in 1610.
Okay.
So
you had basically what it sounds like a good run of about 60 or so years after Xavier and the Portuguese arrive. It looks like Christianity is making some inroads here. Warlord war goes on, and the shogunate takes over and says, we've had it with these missionaries. We're shutting down the borders, essentially.
Yes.
Okay.
And then the Portuguese are the only ones that have the one concession into Nagasaki once a year that they're allowed to do, and that's the only real trade that goes on until Perry sails in the 19th century with his black ships, belching smoke and strutting modern weapons, and that opens up Japan again. But one of the interesting things is during this period, Christianity officially in Japan has been eliminated.
So we're talking 1610 to 1850-ish.
Yes.
Okay.
And the thing is, they come in there, and the thing is, massive persecutions. And this is something that they actually warn about. If you look in some of the art from this period, they'll show Christians praying in a boat and they had rocks tied around their neck, and they're being thrown over into the bay, and that's how they're being executed. They have all sorts of things, and it's a warning to others, you do not become Christian, you do not do this. And so it is very interesting to look at what happens to the Christians in this time period. Now, this is the amazing thing about Christianity in Japan. Now, this is Catholic Christianity from a Catholicism before the Protestant Reformation.
Right, right. Okay. Even though Xavier came a little bit after that, it is definitely the counter-Reformation type of Catholicism. Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's not even really on the window. So the thing is, these Christians only know one Christianity, never heard of any other split. But they end up disappearing into the mines and into the far reaches of Japan in the worst jobs and workplaces where they will not be noticed, or they can do it. And one of the things I noticed when I lived in Japan, I took a tour of like a historical mine that where you go down and you can see it, and they have these wax figures showing how the miners worked and things, kind of like you would see in Disneyland or Knott's Berry Farm or something like that. But as you go along, they have this one little thing, and you see like a priest marrying a small couple. And the thing is, the idea was they actually even acknowledged the fact that this is where all the Christians went. Now, what was amazing was in the 1850s, when Japan suddenly opened up, then suddenly missionaries could come back. And you had Catholic and Protestant missionaries who came flooding into Japan. But to the surprise of the Catholic missionaries who thought that all Christians had been just exterminated in Japan, suddenly out of the depths and things out there, suddenly they get these tugs on their sleeves and said, I'm a Christian.
Wow.
And suddenly, and the thing is, this was something that sent shockwaves all the way to the Vatican. Because here you have had a church existing for over 150 years without any papal control at all. Mm-hmm. Or blessing on the bishop. They basically existed on their own.
Yeah.
So this was a really fascinating thing about the Japanese and those who did commit to Christ, and then they, from there, it basically then they, the Catholic Church, and kind of scooped in and started helping them get back on track for what happened in the church in that time, and then the Protestant missionaries then started evangelizing themselves. And at this time period, you then get kind of the split in Japan. When people in Japan ask a question, and they know, and they ask if you, they find out you're a Christian, they say Protestant or Catholic.
Okay, so there is a division. Do you have any sense of whether the Catholics were a little bit more successful with these remnant Christians at the time, or as Protestants? Because, I mean, you're talking 150, 200 years of separation from the Vatican. Vatican doesn't even know it exists, so they're not getting the encyclicals. They're not getting the papal bulls. One could almost see that this indigenous Christian church is just going to take off in a different direction, and it could become very Protestant in its nature, maybe, you know?
Yeah, though the thing is, surprisingly, it did not.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, I would say that probably the Protestants had more success at converting Japanese to Christianity at this during this time period, where the Catholics kind of got swooped up in basically finding out what had happened to their lost sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually, in bringing them back into the fold, what was amazing was how Orthodox they, and I mean Orthodox small o,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
that they had kept in their beliefs and had managed over that time period, 150 years with very strong persecution, had kept the teachings of Rome as they had existed, as they knew them at the time in 1610.
The story that you tell here, I had no idea this. This is absolutely fascinating to me. It really parallels the first few centuries of Christianity too. Is that, you know, intense persecution? You'd figure everybody would give up and quit. They don't give up and quit. They move into the catacombs, and literally the catacombs, right? You're in the mining industry. You saw this with the, you know, museums that you go underground and see. And they emerged to be a pretty strong church. I mean, it's small in numbers.
Yes.
But pretty intense in their faith.
Yes. And one of the things that I find is that it's kind of an interesting and helps how the church, and I'm going to refer to both churches here. When I say the church, it'll be both Protestant and Catholic, that they shaped Japan. At Japan during what they call the Meiji era, which was started shortly after Japan opened. It was named after the Emperor Meiji, who basically, it's Japan's great leap forward in modernization and what have
right.
you. And Japan basically sent a lot of Japanese abroad to learn the methods and what ways of the barbarians, as they called us, from the West. But they also, what was interesting is the Japanese who went abroad did come back, which is not as common among other nations that had tried the same thing. Japanese really felt an obligation to come back to teach their ways. But then all these missionaries also came in, and they saw this thirst for knowledge and Western ways, so they started opening up schools. And they started coming in as guests to help do things like city planning, like this mentioned the city of Sapporo. It's fifth largest city in Japan. It's one of the few cities in Japan that's laid out on a grid pattern. And that's thanks to a man by the name of William Clark, who came from Massachusetts, who he was a college professor there, and he became a missionary in Japan, spent many years in Japan before returning to his post in Massachusetts. But he really had this idea of actually helping Japan. He brought some things in there. One of the major things that boys are told in school is a saying that he had, boys be ambitious. And the thing is, but what they leave out in the thing, what they teach the students is the fact his whole thing was boys be ambitious for Christ. And that was his, because he was a missionary and what have you. And in Sapporo now there's statues to him and what have you. And he's pointing the way, kind of those types of things where he was so influential on that. So you get all this education coming in. They're building schools. They're building institutions of higher education. And then you basically get this idea that when you look at Christianity in Japan, and particularly I would even say in Protestant Christianity, you see a lot more of the belief among elites as opposed to the more common people, which has led to the fact that there have been at least 7 Japanese prime ministers that have been Christian.
That is fascinating. And that, again, when you talk about missionaries and missionary culture, they often do reach out to the elite oftentimes. In part, they're familiar with it, in part that the elite have a little bit more time and interest to explore this new faith. So that is rather interesting. I mean, you talk about the Meiji era, and I know this is one of the things that I teach in my introduction comparative politics class. There's this interesting tension that you have in Japan during that time between the desire to modernize and to look at the West and say, okay, they're surpassing us technologically. They got bigger ships. They forced us to open. So what are they doing? We need to imitate or build upon what they're doing. But yet, on the other hand, it's fiercely nationalistic, right? So that it's, we want to do it the Japanese way. We want to borrow these different technologies. We want to send our students out to other parts of the world, and we want to bring them back, but we want them to be uniquely Japanese. How does Christianity play into that tension? I mean, are there open arms saying, oh, it must be Christianity that's causing the United States to become such an industrial superpower at this point in time, or Europe, and we should do that too?
It is very interesting to see this, and this plays throughout all of, I think, Japan's modern history, is this tension between hyping all things Western and being Japanese, the nationalistic, the thing, and there's a tension, there's a sway back and forth in the political powers that go on, and that is one of the reasons that particularly the nationalists were battling those who wanted to imitate the West. It's like, okay, those who wanted to imitate the West said, well, we should all become Christian. There's those who advocated intermarriage with Westerners to improve Japan's racial stock. They were like thinking that we were inferior because we're smaller and what have you, not realizing that it's had mostly to do with diet and lack of protein in the diet and things like that. Japanese, if you get around them today, are not necessarily any smaller than a lot of Americans now that they have a lot of protein, and the average Japanese kid eats very well. But putting it back on the focus there is, with the coming of the Meiji Constitution in 1890, there was a slow control that was gained by the nationalists. Those who had the ideas of copying things West were suppressed and pushed down, and particularly, as I mentioned before, Christians on that. But the thing is, then with the defeat of the nationalists by the United States at the end of World War II and the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I want to go back to Nagasaki in a minute here.
Yeah, dude, I want to talk to you about the World War II Japanese expansionary imperialist era, but go ahead, finish your thoughts there.
Yeah, so the thing is, what's interesting is that after the occupation started, one of the very first meetings that the Emperor of Japan had with General MacArthur, who was the commander-in-chief of the Allied forces in the Pacific and basically the occupational governor of Japan, that the Emperor actually told MacArthur, says, your God is stronger than our gods. I will order my nation to convert to Christianity. Please teach us how to be Christian. And he said, and it was MacArthur kind of was like, that's not how it actually works. You can't order people to convert to Christianity. But MacArthur issued a call for 20,000 missionaries to come to Japan to teach Japanese about Christianity, and he got about 200.
Wow.
And that was all. So the thing is, and there was that, but it was kind of that interesting, is that it was that shift, suddenly realizing, okay, we can't do it on our own. Your beliefs, your way is better than our way. We're going over there. And then there was a slow shift back to kind of where Japan is today, where they've kind of given up that necessarily they're not strong nationalists, they're not strong West. They have this thing where they like to copy things in the West, they like to borrow things, but they just don't commit to anything.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of can see this coming out of it, because one of the things that you really have to understand in the Japanese psyche was just how devastated it was by the defeat of World War II.
Well, before we get to the devastation of the defeat of World War II and coming to that, because that is an interesting point too, we skipped a little part of history. So let's take a step back for a moment and talk about, okay, we have the Meiji Restoration at the end of the 1900s. We do have a much larger presence of the nationalists, kind of pushing the Christians out. What happens during the expansionary period? I mean, there was this period of this brief period of democracy under the Emperor Toisho, I believe,
is
pronouncing the name. Yeah. But you know, by the time we start getting in the 1930s, there's imperialist expansion into China, into Korea, into other parts of the Pacific. What happened to Christianity during this period of time?
Okay, Christianity in this period was repressed. It was this, where the idea that you are not Japanese if you aren't Shinto, and there was a way of unifying the country, was everybody has to be Shinto. So, as I mentioned before, Christianity and Buddhism were repressed down. Buddhism, being larger, had a much greater voice to fight, push back. But Christianity was repressed down, not to the point of like it was during the shogunate, where they were executed and killed and what have you. Though there was a little bit of that went on. But the thing is, it was this idea, was it was completely repressed, and it was, you were targeted as being an enemy in many ways, or siding with the enemy by being part of the enemy's religion.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Nagasaki, and you said you wanted to say something about Nagasaki. And again, when we were talking about doing this interview, you brought this up to me. There's something very interesting about Nagasaki, which is the second place the atomic bomb was dropped, and its relation to Christianity and the future of Christianity in Japan. Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, the interesting thing, if you go back to the missionaries where they first landed in southern Japan, the Jesuit missionaries, and that's where they were expelled, but the Portuguese did have access once a year to this area there, which is basically Nagasaki. And in this area that Japan basically had its largest Christian population of any city, which, I mean, numbers vary, but it was like, numbers I've read range from 35% to 60% of Nagasaki was Christian.
Wow, that's when you're talking about such a slim proportion of the entire population being Christian, and that big a proportion of Nagasaki, that's a pretty intense concentration of Christians there.
Yes, yeah. And it was known for its churches, with the crosses. It was very unique in Japan to see it there. And what was just, it's just kind of interesting. I mean, the dropping of the atomic bombs is sad, no matter how you look at it. But the second bomb, the fact that when you look at the history, and it's a different discussion to have, but it's basically, it was a bureaucratic inertia, was that they said the orders were written, drop the bombs until the white flag. And the thing is, they really didn't need to after Hiroshima, but it was just the bureaucratic inertia. And the fact is that it wasn't Fukuoka was the primary target, but it was fogged over in the operational commands that they had to see the target. And so they went to the secondary target, which was Nagasaki, and they barely had enough fuel to do it. And the pilot knew he did not want to land with this bomb in the belly, and they would probably have to jettison our only other work. We only had two, and we'd used one already, and so we were going to have to jettison our last nuclear bomb over the water. And the thing is, it opened up just enough so he was able to see the target, and then he dropped the bomb. And that's the history. But that basically was something where Christianity in Japan has never recovered from that right there, just because it was one place where they actually had a strong core working.
Just numerically, that. Just the numbers. Yeah, one of the great ironies, I guess, of history in that respect. So take us again to the... to come back to what we were talking about just a minute ago, the psychological impact of the surrender in World War II and how that has impacted the religious landscape.
Well, the psychological impact of the surrender was the simple thing is the Emperor Hirohito was, every Japanese was told from birth was a god, and they served for the pleasure of their god, and they did everything in the name of the emperor. Everything, every politician did it in the name of the emperor, every general, every admiral, every lieutenant, every soldier, every person working on a factory line, everything like that was all doing it for the emperor and the emperor's glory. And then to see, and the thing is, if you have your god leading you, and then you're defeated, you're not supposed to be defeated by if you have a god leading you. So it's like, and this
it shakes the foundations of your faith.
Very foundations of it. And then to have your god get on the radio, and most of the Japanese had never even heard his voice. So this actually even led to a lot of skepticism on the Japanese part of whether they actually were receiving the order to basically surrender. And the fact is the emperor declaring in a subsequent radio broadcast that he was not a god, he was merely a mortal. This was one of the things that we... required of him during the occupation to do is this declaration of his mortality and that he was not a god. But it is a lot of Japanese refused to accept it. It's one of the reasons why the occupation was very tough on the military police who came in to occupy, and they had to weed Japanese who refused to believe this out. I mean, people look at the Iraq War and the occupation and how bloody it was. The occupation of Japan was much more bloody, but when you consider how many people were dying on the battlefield on a daily basis, just getting to the point of the surrender,
right?
It's like, okay, we're having two or three a day die instead of
hundreds,
yeah, and like stuff like that, right. And hearing all these reports, so it was just something. It was a different world then, but it was tough. Now, a lot of Japanese did surrender. It did come around, and there was, it's a very interesting, just if you ever wanted in a future interview, just to talk about how some of the effects. I've interviewed myself in the past, some of the officers who came in as part of MacArthur's staff, and how they came to look at the Japanese. They hated the Japanese because, these were officers who gave people that... their soldiers' orders to go into battle and then see them carried out dead 20 minutes later in a stretcher. Mm-hmm. I mean, that affects you when you're the guy who's responsible. You said, go take that hill, and the guy is killed before taking that hill, and it was your order that sent him to his death. But he actually came to understand and respect the Japanese. It's a very interesting thing of Christian forgiveness, and there's some great stories that came out of those 200 missionaries that went to Japan. One of the most notable converts was Captain Fujita, who was the commander of the air raid over Pearl Harbor. He was the highest ranking officer that actually flew over Pearl Harbor. And he became a Christian, and he worked hand-in-hand with a man, I believe his name was Delshazzar, who was part of the Tokyo Raiders, the Doolittle Raid, mm-hmm. that occurred about a few months later.
It's interesting. So you see this high-level guy. He converts, and a lot of missionaries flood in during this period of time, but they don't make as much headway. And one of the questions I want to leave off here with our interview, and we got a little bit of time left, is comparing what happens in Japan over the last 50, 60 years or so, since the end of World War II, with what has gone on in Korea, specifically South Korea, and China. Because South Korea, it's on fire with Christianity. I mean, it's, again, it went through a war, and there were Americans there and all this kind of stuff. But, wow, there's Christians all over the place that you see there. China, you would expect that's not a real fertile environment for any religion to grow. But wow, Christianity is taking off with estimates upwards of around 10% of the population, which again is amazing considering the context. Yet Japan, 1%. Right. What do you think explains that difference?
I'm going to hypothesize here.
That's what we like to do on the show. Yeah.
And I can say, I mean, it's been that you touch on a major question. People don't understand why has Japan been, to use the Christian vernacular, been such stony ground for the gospel? Mm-hmm. It just is not receiving the gospel. People have not converted. I mean, you look at its neighbors in Asia, it just doesn't, there's no comparison to having it be that rejected. And that missionaries and pastors have tried to speculate, they did, but a lot of things, but I think part of it is it's so much of what happened to Japan was tied to religion and belief, the nationalism and what have you through World War II, that I think a lot of Japanese were just burned out with religion. Mm-hmm. They're also kind of suspicious of religion. It's when you're in a mentality where you're hedging your bets and what have you, they've got a lot of groups that go to Japan. You have cults like this Om Shinrikyo, which is kind of a Buddhist cult offshoot. Mm-hmm. It's mostly in Japan and also in Russia, of all places. But then you have many other small groups that have gone to Japan as cults that they're all trying to convert Japanese to their religion, which leads to a very strong skepticism towards any religion. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't explain more the historical, but this is more of a recent phenomenon, particularly as Japan became rich and powerful in the 80s, in the 70s, 80s, and what have you. But I also think there's a lot of introspection in Japan that's going on too, that one of the big things, if you read in the cultural pages, the papers and things like that, is just there's a lot of feeling of shallowness and lack of meaning. Mm-hmm. And particularly among the youth, and like, what is our purpose and where they're looking for it, and they're going out, and it's just kind of, there's, sociologists would describe it as kind of a innate thirst for religion or believing in something greater than oneself. Mm-hmm. I think Japan is still on the path of searching. Mm-hmm. But it's just kind of, they're very, very suspicious of it.
Yeah. So potentially fertile ground, but it's just still very hard to crack in many respects. I can understand that. One other question I want to leave off, and this gets us a little bit away from religion, although it touches upon it, is an issue I've always been fascinated with, or I've been at least fascinated with this recently. One of the more interesting historic trends we see in Japan, as well as a number of modern nations, is the declining fertility rate. And the reason I bring this up is because typically here in the United States, as well as many other countries, including Europe, it's individuals, families, that tend to be much more religious tend to have higher fertility rates. And usually by a fertility rate is how many offspring or children are produced per woman. And in sociological terms, that's usually you need to have 2.1 to reproduce a population generation after generation. In Japan, that number is quite low. It's the fertility rate, I think, is about 1.39. It's been low for a long time. And the average or the median population age is 45. It's a relatively older population, that you don't have that many youth. What are your thoughts about that, the fertility rate, and maybe how it's linked to religion?
Well, in my eyeball estimation, I mean, what you say there about religious people having more children would be, I think, true. Many of in my church in Japan, they tend to have more, the couples have more children. But it has been something that the Japanese government has tried every way they know how, from financial incentives to more generous time off for women, everything like that, every trick in the book to basically have more children.
Yeah, more kids, yeah.
And people have speculated. Nobody really knows, but it's like choices that women are making not to have children. One of the things is the expense of education, that it takes a lot of money to educate a child because they don't have any student loans for college and everything. The family has to save up and plan for their child's education. They have to do that. So that's usually considered one of the barriers. There's not a tradition of scholarships. Also, along those lines, which actually, on a separate little note, is kind of interesting. It keeps the cost of higher education down, but still it's expensive to educate a child. So I look at that and I say, okay, what does this explain? I just really don't know. I mean, one of the things you could get, and again, I'm speculating, hypothesizing, is having children represents hope. Mm-hmm. Hope for the future, a better thing like that. And maybe if a lot of Japanese really just wonder about what kind of world they're bringing a child into, are choosing not to. And Japan was one of the first nations to allow abortion as a form of birth control very early on in their history it was in the early 50s that it became legalized. And so it is very easy to not have children and all the things that go with it. I mean, but I could get into some more of the sort of details of the government's more comical ways of trying to get the Japanese population up, but they are a declining population. It started in 2007, 2 years before it was expected. It was supposed to happen in 2009, the Japanese population would peak, but it actually peaked 2 years early and is now in a declining population, aging. It's one of the reasons Japan is working so much on robotics is they just don't have enough youth to take care of the elderly.
Mm-hmm. And so robots in the future will have to do that. Maybe they could have robot pastors. I don't know.
That would be interesting.
Well, Kevin, I think that's a very good place to end up our discussion on Japan here. I've learned a lot from this, and I appreciate you coming on to Research on Religion to talk about this.
Yes, and I thank you again.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.